Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 52 of NML Crossing, where, well, we're doing the other half of that Asriel story we started last time. For better or for worse, probably both. It's better that we're getting it over with, worse that we actually have to discuss it. And today, my friends, it's been a day here at the house. So, this is a kind of a monkey paw escape here, you know. I'm looking for a way to escape real life, and unfortunately that road goes directly through Asriel land. So, without any ado today, let's hop on in. We're going to be looking at Asriel, Agent of the Bat number 51. Had an April 1999 cover date. The story's called Miracle Run, written by Denny O'Neill. Pencils, Roger Robinson. Inks, James Pasco. Colors, Demetrius Basukos and Prismacolor. Letters, Ken Brusenak. Edits, Berrios and Carlin. Cover price, 2.25. Now we open with our new-look hero standing in the rain while looking at the remains of that house that burned down last issue. Now he uses his headsock comlink to call some emergency services to attend to the remaining survivors. Unfortunately for him, while he's making that call, the Yokel squad is coming too and, well, they're arming up. Asriel's able to talk them into not attacking him with their pointy sticks and blunt objects, and he pretty much just tells them that he dragged their sorry asses out of the blaze, which, you know, one good turn deserves another, right? We follow Asriel as he narrates everything to himself. You see, his old Asriel suit burned up in that house fire, so whether he likes it or not, he's stuck with the gear from Gambit's garage sale. He spots Lade's footprints. Lade, of course, the fellow who he was trying to track down, Nick Scratch's old office mate or lab mate or wherever the hell they worked, I don't know. And he had disappeared when Asriel was pulling the yokels out of the fire. But he left a trail of footprints, not too difficult to do since it's been raining and the entire area is basically mud and dirt roads. And so our man, maybe he's the second greatest detective on the planet, he deduces that Lade likely ran off to the nearby church that those footprints are going to. Meanwhile, we rejoin our devil heads from last issue, and they've taken shelter in a nearby abandoned barn after their vehicle broke down. And they spend several panels pondering whether or not Nick Scratch made it so their car crapped the bed. Like it was... they also spy a trio of pitchforks, which they take as a sign from their geeky lord and savior. Three pitchforks to three devil heads, so it was all meant to be? Or something? I don't know. Back to Asriel. Now, he's arrived at that old church, and it looks like Lade has never had to cover his tracks before. Because even someone like me, or John Paul Valley, could have tracked him down. There are footprints everywhere, there's dust disturbed, and after going through a not-so-secret passage, our hero finds his target, and he's immediately attacked by him. Well, threatened to be attacked by him. Lade is just standing there like an idiot while brandishing a pipe or something. Almost like a Y Iota sort of a stance. Lade claims not to recognize him due to him wearing the new duds. It doesn't take much for Asriel to convince him, though. Lade reveals that this not-so-secret passage was actually a way station for the Underground Railroad, and it's a place that he retreats to every so often when he needs to be alone. From here, we enter into a bit of an interrogation, which leads to an exposition dump. Asriel asks about Nick Scratch's family, which, didn't we already do this? I don't know, maybe Lade's had time to sleep on it. I don't know. Because despite the fact that this isn't a day later or anything, Lade does open up. And he says that Nick Scratch has an uncle who owns a fishing lodge at Dixon Lake near Bloodhaven, Bludhaven. Which, must be where Nick Scratch is, right? Like, seriously. It's just that easy. We're given one single possibility as to where Nick Scratch might be holed up, and it's going to pay off. Lade tells Asriel that he can consider this old church a second home if he ever needs it, which feels a bit soon, right? Like, hey, you costumed weirdo with the gravelly voice who might have killed a senator a few weeks ago. You want to be roomies? They also debate as to whether or not our man is a literal angel, which is something. From here, we follow our hero into the lightning storm outside, and he's nearly hit with several bolts of the stuff. Now, he deftly dodges a biggie before hearing the voices of our friends, the Devilheads. JPV tries to engage with them diplomatically, asking them why they decided to give up their lives in order to follow Nicholas J. Scratch. And they all respond that their lives were meaningless and dull before hooking up with the man of the century. You see, he gives them purpose and direction. Unfortunately for them, however, he doesn't give them lessons in fighting or being entertaining or anything, really. They kind of suck, just like Nick Scratch. Now, while Asriel tries to plan his self-defense strategy utilizing his new costume, he, just as the cover shows us, is struck by a bolt of lightning. Like, for real, we get a full-page spread of this idiot getting hit with lightning. He hits the ground, and he's immediately swarmed by the Devilheads. One kind of gives him, like, a nudge with the side of his foot before proclaiming that their job here is done. Famous last words, geek, because then Asriel pulls himself up to his feet. Not quite as dramatic as what Batman did when he was trying to reclaim, what was it, Newtown? Wherever the ventriloquist was holed up. But, I guess semi-dramatic all the same? I don't know. Anyway, now standing, our man relieves one of the Devilheads of his pitchforks, and he starts swinging. From here, we get a few pages of Asriel beating the holy hell out of the baddies before walking away like he's some sort of faux badass, which almost feels like parody, considering how silly our hero looks today. It's like something I would have drawn in seventh grade. You know, Robinson is talented, of course. I was not, and I still am not. But it's like this very faux badass sort of thing. Anyway, we wrap up the issue with Asriel driving his Volkswagen toward Uncle Scratch's fishing lodge. Upon arrival, he finds himself greeted by a note left on the door. And it's from his pal, Nikki, which reveals that our big bad has decided to head to Gotham City, the place he hates the most. So I guess this feud must continue? Thankfully for us, not until episode 64. But that's the end of it. Next time out, we're going to be kicking off our four-part Fear of Faith storyline in our first No Man's Land issues of Legends of the Dark Knight. But for now, I suppose we ought to try talking about our Asriel two-parter. Man, this is going to be a short episode, isn't it? Yeah, what do you say about this? I think I kind of robbed Peter to pay Paul last time when I was trying to come up with things to say about this, because it's all the same stuff. This feels so very dated. You know, we get one lead given to us, and of course it pans out. Of course it works. The scenes just look like almost something out of an early Image comic. You know, it's like just a lot of tough talk, a lot of faux badassery and fighting. And the story is just so shallow. It's not ideal. I'm still glad we're covering it for completionist's sake, but boy, I have yet to meet a single person who has had anything nice to say about an issue of Asriel. If I'm describing you, if you are someone who loves the Asriel series, or even just tolerates the Asriel series, let me know, because I hate bagging on a book. I hate bagging on a book that's written by a legend in the industry who's responsible for a lot of seminal stories and timeless stories. This just ain't it. And I think when we first covered Asriel, the first issue on the show, I compared the feeling that I got from reading it to like post-2000s Chris Claremont on X-Men, where the voice is there, but the voice is not, the voice just doesn't match up with the time anymore. And it's kind of depressing. It's kind of sad. You know, that there really isn't a whole heck of a lot to say about this, or a whole heck of a lot positive to say about this. Like, I wish I could tell you right now that I can't wait for the next Asriel issue. And I can say that ironically, I guess, or with a morbid curiosity, because at least the next Asriel books we're going to cover will have him in Gotham. Unfortunately, Nick Scratch is also in Gotham for whatever. I mean, Nick Scratch has been anti-Gotham for as long as we've known the man. And here, after it's been cut off from the rest of the country, he decides to go into Gotham. I don't know. I don't know. The art was nice. I'll give it that. The art was nice. But that's really about it. I really don't want to keep relitigating this issue. So I think, unfortunately, that's where I'm going to have to leave it. Not a whole heck of a lot to say. Not a whole heck of a lot to recommend. Not a whole heck of a lot going on. But onward and upward. Before we cut out of here, we do have some letters in the NML bag to discuss, thankfully, because, boy, this would have been a very short episode without them. We're going to start with our friend Chris Yu, who says, I think I own this, and he's talking about the last issue of Asriel we discussed, issue number 50. He says, I think I own this, and I read it back in the day, but as with all things Asriel and Nicholas Scratch, I don't remember any of it. I didn't even remember that Asriel wore another costume other than the original. And I only knew that myself because I read the Joker's Last Laugh tie-in issue of Asriel. And I think I've talked about that here on the show where it's like I had two things pop into my head when I saw that that was part of the crossover. It was like, wow, Asriel's still going on? And the other was like, wow, Asriel's got an ugly costume. And both things were true. Chris continues, I'm a little confused on when this actually takes place. Did Batman go see Jean-Paul before returning to Gotham, or did he leave Gotham after taking down Scarface to go see Jean-Paul and then go back? And you know, that's an excellent question that I bet nobody bothered to ask Denny when he wrote this script, because I couldn't tell you when this happened, and if Batman can come and go from Gotham, maybe we'll find out. Maybe we'll find out as we go deeper here. I would imagine Batman's got a way out, right? Especially since he disappeared for 90 days or whatever it was, or 100 days, was it? So I don't think he was just laying low, skulking the sewers of Gotham City for 3 months, though I could be wrong. I could be wrong. Chris continues, and Nick Scratch appears to be in a quake-damaged building. Is he in Gotham after it became a no-man's land? Apparently so. Apparently so. He stopped by Uncle Scratch's cabin before heading into no-man's land. Weird. Chris continues, since no-man's land's been going on for 3 months before Batman returned, has Scratch just been sitting around all that time? This feels like it should have been part of the road to no-man's land and not no-man's land proper. I agree with you completely. This feels like it could have been a second Road to No Man's Land arc, because our man is literally on the road to No Man's Land right now, right? He's leaving the cabin and he's heading to Gotham. And as for Scratch, I wonder if he's just been hanging around Gotham City for 3 months. It'd be weird that the literal man of the century, his whereabouts are unknown for a long, long time. But I guess in 12 episodes' time, we will hopefully get some clarity on the whereabouts of Nicholas Scratch and when he got to Gotham, when he decided to go to Gotham, why he decided to go to Gotham. Oh, boy. Yeah, all that Nick Scratch stuff, we'll hopefully find that out in 12 or so episodes' time. But thank you so much for writing in, Chris, and raising some inconvenient questions here about the whens and whys of JPV and his arch nemesis. Next, we got a letter from our friend Eric, and he says, No Man's Land so far is really, really good. I like how they changed things by making characters into territory leaders. Our characters have to change the way they think, and they need to do things differently. There's one scene where Batman saves Alfred and the goon falls in the river and the mine explodes. Usually Batman would be very careful to preserve life, but this time it's like he doesn't even care that someone died. That's an interesting point that I didn't even think about. You know, it was such a well-choreographed scene, and it actually, you know, it paid things forward. Because the question was, are there mines in the water? And we got our answer. I never even stopped to think about Batman letting it happen and not doing whatever he could to stop it from happening. So that's a really interesting point. Eric continues, I do not like Azrael's new costume, and I can see why they changed it back later on in his series. Yeah, it's a bad costume. It is a... Yeah, like I mentioned earlier, it looks like something out of Gambit's garage sale. Those head socks were all the rage in the early 90s. You'd be hard-pressed to find a hero without one. Cyclops had one. Hank Pym had one. I think Cable had a stint with one during Fatal Attractions. Every other Image character had one. They were a high-fashion item back in the long ago. Eric continues... talking about Zero Hour, we talked about Zero Hour briefly last episode, and Eric says, I think Parallax was not really the villain because he wanted to, what he wanted to accomplish is what happens. The event was basically a way to reboot things, so it was more just a different point of view than pure villainy. It was not the way Parallax planned to restore things, but a lot was restored. Parallax was a villain for killing the Green Lanterns and the Guardians. In Zero Hour, the only one that seemed to be truly a villain was Extant. I still think Hal's sacrifice at the end of Final Night redeems his villainy, but he should have never been brought back to life. Kyle Rayner should have just continued until they created a new Lantern to succeed him. A lot to unpack there. You hit the nail on the head there. Parallax, as you read Zero Hour, you start Zero Hour and it's like, oh, okay, Parallax is the bad guy. He just killed the Core, he just killed the Guardians, he destroyed the power battery, made it so there's only one Lantern left. You know, he did a lot of bad stuff. But with Zero Hour, Zero Hour was the beginning of his redemption arc to me. What he was trying to give everybody was what they wanted in their wildest dreams. You know, he wanted to give everybody their perfect world, which, of course, you know, that could be the old Twilight Zone monkey's paw sort of thing, but at the core of it, Hal was just trying to do right. And the funny thing is here, and Eric brings it up, is that a lot of what Parallax was setting out to do happened. You know, it's like the heroes are like, no, you're not going to reshape the universe. And then like three pages later, they reshape the universe. It's very, very bizarre. Now, Hal sacrificing himself at the end of the final night, that makes total sense to me. And does a lot to, I guess, redeem him on I can't say every level, but on many levels. Because when he was brought back, there were some doubting Thomases, or some doubting Bruces, I guess. Bruce and Hal's scenes post-Green Lantern Rebirth were really well written for the most part. Because Batman never fully trusted Hal again until, you know, they flushed all the continuity down the toilet. So it's not like Hal got off completely scot-free or didn't wipe the slate entirely clean, even after all the Parallax, you know, giant fear bug sort of retcons they put into it. But as for Hal's return, I mostly agree. One of the things I loved about DC around the turn of the century was how it felt like it was a maturing universe, right? You know, we didn't have Hal, we didn't have Barry. We had these younger characters who had taken the legacy roles and had really made them their own. I was a big fan of Kyle Rayner. I even enjoyed the Judd Winnick stuff with Kyle, which... Winnick wasn't always an easy sell for me, but I really enjoyed what he did with Kyle. I liked the more Earth-based Green Lantern stuff, and a lot of the Kyle run was on Earth. And I really dig that. And when they start going into space or they start going into various sectors, I kind of gloss over a little bit. I never like when like the Titans or the X-Men go into space. I guess I can't connect with them. I just really don't get much out of them. Now, Hal being brought back, I didn't have as much of a problem with Hal coming back as I did with Barry. Yeah, when they brought Barry back, it felt like there were no more rules. It's like, okay, we're just going to do whatever. When they brought Hal back, it's like, okay, it's Geoff Johns really likes this character, yada, yada, yada. But there's a Green Lantern Corps, so it's like, okay, so he'll be back, and Kyle can still do his thing, and maybe we'll get, you know, I'm not sure what I was expecting, to be honest, but it certainly wasn't what we got. So when it was happening, I was kind of cool with it. When Barry came back, there was a lot of writing on that wall. I grew up with Wally. You know, I never knew Barry as the Flash. Wally was my Flash from day one. So I kind of knew that he was going to get backburnered. And that's exactly what happened. Backburnered to the point where he actually disappeared post the New 52. But I'm very much in agreement that, you know, we should have successors. There should be legacy characters. Some of the stuff about Kyle's run that I enjoyed so much was the fact that he would confer with some of the old Green Lanterns, and they were actually depicted as being old Green Lanterns. John Stewart, Guy Gardner, they actually looked older. They were like in retirement, and he would go to them for counsel or for advice, and I really thought that was really cool. And you know, jumping over to the Flash again, Barry was this mythical character who Wally would aspire to be like, and knew that he'd never be able to escape the shadow of him. So when he comes back, it was kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, which was unfortunate. And I would really love for there to be successors again. Unfortunately, that's just not how things work anymore. Instead of getting a new Green Lantern or a new Flash, it's like, here's another Green Lantern and another Flash. It's, you know, the Spider-Verse everywhere. The Spider-Verse has spread into every comics property, and it's, it really sucks. It's like, where do you go from there? You know, everything is multiversal now. And there's 7,000 flavors of Spider-Man, so how do you make any of them special? How do you move forward? How do you go to the next thing when you've already done everything? That's what we get with we got tons of Lanterns, we got tons of Flashes, we've got tons of Batman, we've got tons of Supermen. I was talking to a buddy of mine about, was it Action Comics 1051, which was a book that I was going to start reviewing on the blog, a la our, you know, Action Comics Weekly, because Action Comics was once again a sort of kind of anthology. There were like three or four stories running in each issue, and I thought it would be appropriate to cover, you know, the next anthology of Action Comics on the Chris's on Infinite Earths blog. And I read the first story in there, and there's a scene where there's something like 15 people with S's on their shirts in the sky. And it was just, wow. And then you look, and there's only one that can actually maintain an ongoing series. And you wonder why they're so willing to flood these books with characters that can't even carry their own books. It's, you know, I guess it's just a sign of the times. We go the direction of the Spider-Verse, no matter if it bears fruit or not. And that was one hell of a tangent from Zero Hour, wasn't it? Oof. Okay, Eric continues. The Joker Year One was disappointing. I agree. I very, very much agree. I'm not sure what I expected from it. I mean, when you're dealing in a Bat book and you bring Year One up, it kind of sets an expectation that it's going to be an evergreen, seminal type of story. This was not that. This was unfortunately not that. I didn't dislike it, but I was very underwhelmed by it. Maybe maybe a year from now, I can look back on it and be like, okay, well, that was necessary for what was to come. But in reading it as just the next few issues of Batman, it wasn't what I wanted it to be. It wasn't what I expected it to be, and it was disappointing. Eric continues. When Zarsky's run was announced, they had a failsafe video trailer on DC's YouTube site. It showed three Jokers, so I knew they were eventually going to reach that topic, but it was not what I was expecting. And again, I agree 100%. Eric continues by saying, on another topic, I'm finally going to start reading X-Men again from where I left off. I won't be reading every series, but I spent quite a few hours chronicling what to read in order to get caught up to the present day. And I envy you the ability to do that. I am still kind of gun-shy for any X-reads for the next little while. I think I went too deep. You don't go full X, and I went way too full X. I wouldn't even know where to begin trying to catch up. Where did I leave off? I left off with the Free Comic Book Day issue right before Judgment Day, or Judgment War. Judgment Day, I think it was, the Avengers, Eternals, X-Men thing. I read and I covered that Free Comic Book Day issue, and that was it. That was it. I couldn't go any further. I read a few more, and I wrote scripts for a few more, but that was it. And unfortunately, after seeing the new slew of X-books that are coming post-Krakoa, those don't really inspire much hope in me. Launching 9 books at once is very on-brand for Marvel and the X-Men, but that's just too damn many books. And some of them are kind of like cutesy. We got like an NYX again. I don't know. And I'm not thrilled about the creative teams. So, since I am a complete idiot, I'll still be buying them. So I'm part of the problem, to be sure. But I'm not sure how deep I'm going to get into reading them, unfortunately. Part of me was hoping this would lead to a re-X-lapsed sort of series. But it didn't take long to make me second guess that. But that's where Eric leaves off. I want to thank him so much for writing in. And also, where did you leave off in the X-Men? Let me know. I want to know how much reading you got in store. You said you spent a few hours chronicling, so that suggests you have a lot of reading to do. I want to know where you left off. But thanks again so much for writing in. And of course, if anybody would like to write in and join the conversation, if you want to talk, hey, you want to tell me where you left the X-Men, or if you're still reading the X-Men and I'm just a buffoon for quitting when I did, let me know. Hit me up. You could find me all those different ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, chrisandreggie.podbean.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com. Also, all the social media places. But I think I dragged this episode on as long as I possibly could. We almost got a half hour. Maybe after theme music, it will be a half hour. I didn't think I'd be able to get a half hour on Asriel number 51, but here we are. But I'd like to thank you all so much for joining me in this insanity today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to think straight. Starting over after it breaks. Starting over when the story's got an astounding twist. You better turn that page. When push it comes to shove, we do not fall out of love. We